As I said this morning, we're going to study together about Judaism this evening. Occasionally, we'll take some time out and we'll look at the beliefs of some folks around us who may not believe the same things we do. And it's helpful for us to understand where our friends and neighbors around us are coming from. And you may not know as many people in this part of the country that are actively involved in Judaism as maybe some other parts of the country. But I've had a friend or two in my past whose families were Jewish and they consider themselves religiously Jewish, not particularly active in the faith, but certainly believed it as a system of faith. And so it's good for us to understand. I think we talk about Judaism a lot in the Old Testament and New Testament context, but in terms of what Jews today believe, maybe not so much. And so I think it's good for us to take a little bit of time out to help us understand the belief system of modern day Jews. Now, I will say that, of course, we've talked about the fact that you have to be careful when you say, well, a Baptist believes this or a Methodist believes that, because, you know, about the time you start talking to one of your friends, you don't need to preach to them and tell them what they believe. You need to let them tell you what they believe, because there are variations in their differences of opinion, even within these religions. And that's certainly true of Judaism. As we all know, Judaism began as the religion of the children of Israel. There was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God changed Jacob's name to Israel, and so all of his sons and the resulting tribes, all of the descendants of Israel, became the children of Israel. They ended up in Egypt. Things went well until a Pharaoh rose up that didn't know Joseph, and then they ended up in bondage or slavery in Egypt. Moses leads the people out of Israel, and when they get to Mount Sinai, Moses is given the law by God, and God, of course, gives the law to the Israelite people. This was a law that was specific to the Israelite people. It wasn't a law for everybody in the world. God gave this written law to the Israelites as a nation. He was their chosen people. Within this law and in the subsequent prophets, writings of the prophets, there was a Messiah who was promised. And certainly Israelites throughout the ages have watched for a Messiah. He was promised to come through the lineage of King David. We also know from Jewish history that the Israelites were repeatedly punished for their unfaithfulness to God and their rebelliousness against God and getting involved in idol worship and those kind of things. During the period of the judges, he would punish them. They would repent. He would raise up a judge to rescue them. And then a few years later, they would fall back into idol worship. And it was kind of a cycle. Finally, toward the end of the period of the kings, God had had enough. The northern 10 tribes were carried away into Assyrian captivity, really never to be heard from again. The southern tribes were taken into Babylonian captivity, and that's when many of the prophecies of the restoration of Israel and the coming of Messiah and so forth were written and were taught by the prophets. And so there was supposed to be a restoration of Israel, the coming of Messiah, and the establishment of his kingdom. Now we're going to get back to that, but that's where a lot of the questions come up. When we think of Jesus of Nazareth, this is really the crux of the issue. I've had a few discussions with a friend of mine who was Jewish, and he would say, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure what the big deal is. You know, Jesus was a good guy, and, you know, I don't know why there'd be so much consternation between Jews and Christians. Well, you know, the problem is that Jesus didn't just claim to be a pretty good guy. That's the problem. Jesus claimed to be divine, the Son of God. He was the Messiah, and that separates people. I mean, we can treat each other with dignity and respect, but we can't be in agreement. I can't agree that you're okay and you agree that I'm okay. Jesus was either who he claimed to be or he was a charlatan and a fraud. It was one or the other, and so that's the reason it is such a bone of contention, if you will. But if you look at the New Testament view of Jesus of Nazareth as Messiah, what you find is that the kingdom is presented as being a spiritual kingdom and not of this world. That's what Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my followers would fight so that I would not be turned over to the Jews. But as it is, they're not fighting because my kingdom is not from here." It's a spiritual kingdom, and frankly, it was intended by God and the Godhead to be a spiritual kingdom throughout the entire plan. It wasn't a last minute change in their plans. Every time there was a prophecy in the Old Testament about the coming of the kingdom, it was intended to be a spiritual kingdom. The Apostle Paul, who by the way was Saul of Tarsus, that was his Jewish name, was Saul, was an Israelite of Israelites, as we heard in our reading this evening. He was a Hebrew of Hebrews, and yet when he was converted to Christ, he made it very clear that restored Israel was all of us. It was Jews and Gentiles. There's neither bond nor free, male nor female, Jew or Gentile. We're all one in Christ Jesus. He said that those who are of the circumcision not made with hands, those who have the faith of Abraham, are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise, is what Paul said. And so, yes, Israel was supposed to be restored, and yes, Israel was restored in the first century, and we're part of restored Israel right now, even though none of us probably have Jewish ancestors. And then finally, Jesus fulfilled every word of prophecy from the Old Testament perfectly as Messiah. Now, the prevailing, and I say prevailing because there are differences of opinion, but the prevailing Jewish view is that they were looking for an earthly kingdom. And I realize we've talked about that in our Bible classes. That seems to be what the New Testament is suggesting about the misconceptions of first century Jews. But when you read current Jewish literature, and most of my references are going to be from the Jewish Virtual Library, and it's an excellent resource. I would recommend it if you'd like to read, do some reading. But according to the Jewish Virtual Library, there even today, the reason they rejected Christ was because they were looking for an earthly kingdom. Physical Israel has yet to be restored according to prophecy, and therefore they're still looking for Messiah to come and establish an earthly king. An earthly kingdom of the Jews with a descendant of David sitting on his throne. That's the difference in the two views, and they are miles apart. You can't reconcile the two. And again, we may be friendly, we may treat each other with dignity and respect, but you can't reconcile these two views. They are diametrically opposed. Now, Judaism, I believe, is a loosely defined entity. Okay, it's not like Catholicism where you have a very structured organization with the Pope at the top and the archbishops and the bishops and the priests. And it's not, I mean, Judaism is a very loosely defined entity. It is a religion, it is a nationality, and it's a culture. If you read the Jewish Virtual Library, Jews range all the way from ethnic Jews, people who say, I'm from a Jewish family, but I have no religious beliefs. I may be atheistic, but I'm from a Jewish descendants. It ranges all the way from people who consider themselves simply ethnic Jews all the way to the convictions of Orthodox Jews who are very conservative and very specific about what they believe, and they engage in certain practices because of their religious beliefs. And so it runs the gamut. We're going to consider some of the prevalent beliefs of those who are devoted to Judaism. I think that's the best way to look at it. Those who take it as a system of religious belief. They look to what they call the Torah, both written and oral, as their religious authority. Now, they define the Torah as the five books written by Moses. We sometimes call them the Pentateuch, or simply, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But also in about 200 AD, there was a rabbi named Judah who wrote some writings that are now referred to as Mishnah. And there was oral law. There were oral traditions. And so in 200 AD, Mishnah, rather than leaving them oral, wrote many of those down. And they still use that as a reference today. In about 400 AD, there were other rabbis who contributed writings and opinions on various religious topics. And when those were compiled, they refer to that as the Talmud. And you may have heard that referred to from time to time. That was really created in around 400 AD, but there have been revisions since then. So you had the five books that Moses wrote, and the Mishnah from Rabbi Judah in 200 AD, and the Talmud from other rabbis from 400 AD on. And they consider all of those of divine origin. Now, if you recall from our studies in the New Testament, Jesus took issue on a regular basis with the leaders of the Jews in the first century, putting as much stock in their traditions and the traditions of the fathers as they did what God had said in the law that he gave to Moses. And Jesus said, "You're getting yourself in trouble doing that." And he gave them a number of examples of traditions that they were going by as if it was gospel, if you will, when in fact they had developed traditions that contradicted and conflicted with what God had commanded, and they were causing people to sin by following their traditions instead of doing what God had said. Well, that was the case, and we see an example of that in Matthew chapter 15 and a lot of other places, and it appears that people actively involved in Judaism today are making the same mistake. They're putting as much stock in tradition as they do in what God actually said to Moses in written form. Of course, they're not concerned about what Jesus of Nazareth said, and I wouldn't either if I didn't believe he was anybody special. But there, it appears that they're making the same mistake that first century Jews were making. Well, I just threw a couple of these in to give you a little bit of an idea, and I'm not poking fun at people involved in Judaism. I'm going to make a point here in a minute, and I think you'll see the point. But there's a rabbi, and I'm going to struggle with these names, but Eleazar ben Yossi, the Galilean, wrote that for 974 generations before the creation of the world, the Torah lay in God's bosom and joined the ministering angels in song. Okay. Now, where he got this idea, I don't know. I don't know if he got a revelation or a vision of some kind, but that was 974 generations before the creation. Simeon ben Lachish taught that the Torah preceded the world by 2,000 years and was written in black fire upon white fire. I have no idea what that means. My point is, and again, I'm not singling out Judaism. I'm saying the more we study, you get on denominational websites, you get on websites of about any religion out there, and you start reading things that their followers and their leaders have written, and it's amazing how creative man can get. God has told us everything we need to know about origins. He's told us everything about we need to know about where his law came from, and yet these fellows are writing about things that happened 2,000 years or 974 generations before the creation of the world, and not a bit of revelation to back it up. They just get creative, and people accept that as tradition, and now it's just as reliable as the writings of the scriptures that Moses gave. It is creativity, but it's audacity for people to take it upon themselves to do that and expect other people to listen to them and follow them. But again, it's not unique to Judaism. There are religious leaders all out there that are doing that. And that's one reason when I stand in this pulpit or anybody else stands in this pulpit, if I tell you anything and I can't give you book, chapter, and verse, send me out the door. You don't need it. And that's the problem in the religious world today, is people accepting stuff like that when there's no justification for it. There's no authority from God for it. It's all purely tradition. Well, there are some things that you've probably heard about Judaism that we probably ought to mention briefly, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on them. But they have a number of holidays, and frankly, most of these holidays come right out of the Old Testament, to their credit. Okay, now they put different names on them, but they refer back to feast days that were instituted in the Old Testament: Day of Atonement, Feast of Tabernacles, Festival of Weeks, Passover, those kinds of things. The Purim was instituted in the book of Esther to celebrate God's deliverance of the Israelite people on that occasion, and so forth. Hanukkah, we've heard about, came from the rededication of the temple after the Greeks had desecrated the temple. The Maccabees and others regained control of Palestine, cleaned up the temple, rededicated the temple, and there's a story about having only one day's worth of oil before they could acquire more, and yet one day's worth of oil burned for 8 days, and so they've added some extra wings onto the menorah because of that. But they celebrate Hanukkah because of that, the rededication of the temple. Most of their dietary restrictions today go back to the guidelines and the rules that were laid out in the law of Moses, so that's to their credit. It is not necessary for a food to be blessed by a rabbi for a Jew to eat it. Okay? If you're a farmer, you're growing stuff, you know where it came from, you eat it, and you know it matches what the law of Moses says, that's fine. The problem today is there are so many processed foods, there's no telling what goes on in the factory, and you don't know whether they're adding some ingredients in that God wouldn't allow. And so, in fact, Perry Bratton used to be the quality guy at one of the biscuit companies over, a few miles from here. But they had a line of kosher crackers that they made, and a rabbi actually came in and investigated the whole process, made sure everything was okay, and then he blessed that as being kosher. I understand. I'm not making fun of that at all. I understand that. And I'll tell you, if I were still a Jew today and we had all this processed food, you'd have to do that. You don't know what's in there. And that's what they do. And that's why you hear about rabbis blessing kosher foods of today. But it's not necessary. If you read on their website, a lot of times you'll see when they refer to God, they'll put G-D and they won't spell God. And the reason is because somewhere in their traditions, not in the old law of Moses, but somewhere in their traditions, if anybody messed up while they're writing the name of God, or they write the name of God and decided to delete it later, not supposed to do that, okay? And so in order to avoid that risk, they just don't spell the name. Now, I have my doubts about whether G-D in English means the same thing as G-O-D, and I don't know, but we could argue about that, but that's the reason, is they're serious. Now, I've heard stories about Jewish scribes who would be scribing copies of the Bible, and when they would come to the name of God, they would get up and wash, change their clothes, make sure their pen tip was nice and clean and only had just the right amount of ink, so that when they wrote the name of God, they wouldn't get a blob of ink. I don't have a problem with that. That's showing respect and reverence for God. But to make that a requirement was simply a tradition. It's not part of the old law of Moses. Now, I'd like to investigate real quick three main concepts. We could do a whole series on Judaism. Not going to do that. But three things. Number one, what's their concept of Messiah? That's extremely important. Number two, what's their position regarding animal sacrifices? We got to answer that question. You see all the, we've been doing our Bible reading. You get through the book of Leviticus and it will drive you insane. Trying to keep straight how every little detail of what they had to do. Why aren't they doing that now if they're still waiting for Messiah? And number three, what is Zionism and what does that have to do with Judaism today? Okay. Well, there's some skepticism among some Jews about the coming of Messiah, or people jumping up and saying, listen to me, I'm Messiah, because it's been going on for centuries. And even back in the first century, and I'm not going to try to name this fellow's name, but there was a first century sage among Jews in the first century who said, if you should happen to be holding a sapling in your hand when they tell you that the Messiah has arrived, first plant the sapling and then go out and greet the Messiah. Okay? I think what he's saying is, they come every day. Don't get too excited. Somebody says they're Messiah. Go ahead and plant your sapling and then go investigate it, because it happened fairly frequently. There's an old Jewish story of a Russian. There was a Russian village who paid a Jew. It was a Jewish village in Russia, and they paid a fellow full time to sit at the edge of town and watch for Messiah, so that they would have early warning if he saw him coming. And one of his friends said, "But the pay is low." And he said, "Well, true, but the job is permanent." Okay, and it's a joke among Jews, and that is, he hadn't come yet. I think I've got a full time job for the rest of my life watching for Messiah. But I'll tell you, there are other people even today who are passionate about it. Okay? And I believe that's appropriate. If Jesus of Nazareth was not the Messiah, people still ought to be passionate watching for him, shouldn't they? And so there are people who are part of Judaism that are still passionately watching for the coming of Messiah. Well, five characteristics that nearly every religious Jew will agree to regarding Messiah, and that is, he's a descendant of King David. He's going to gain sovereignty over the land of Israel. Three, he's going to gather the Jews there from the four corners of the earth. Number four, he's going to restore them to the full observance of Torah law. And number five, he's going to bring peace to the whole world. That's sort of the five common things that they would agree Messiah represents. In the Jewish virtual library, they said the most basic reason for the Jewish denial of messianic claims made on Jesus' behalf is that he did not usher in world peace as Isaiah had prophesied. prophesied, okay? So Messiah is supposed to usher in world peace. Jesus didn't do that, therefore he couldn't be Messiah. Number two, in addition, Jesus did not help bring about Jewish political sovereignty for the Jews or protection from their enemies. So Jesus came and went. The Romans were still in power. The Jews were still under the thumb of the Romans. He couldn't have been the Messiah, okay? Well, I think you can see the problem of where that's heading, okay? They make the same mistake that people who claim to be Christians, but they are premillennialists. It's amazing how close the thinking is of these two groups of people. One group believes that Jesus of Nazareth was not the Messiah. The other group believes that Jesus was the Messiah, but they're all looking for this earthly kingdom and earthly peace and a Messiah to sit for Jesus to sit on an earthly throne in the city of Jerusalem and reign over the Jewish people in Palestine. That's the big mistake. And so a lot of the logic behind their rejecting Jesus as Messiah was simply because they were looking for a physical king, for a physical nation, physical sovereignty for Israel. That didn't happen, and so they were disillusioned. They couldn't accept a Messiah like that. Now, Reform Judaism, we would consider, most people would consider, even the Jewish Virtual Library would consider, you know, the more liberal wing of Judaism. And they don't really believe in an individual, they're not looking for an individual Messiah anymore, okay? It's more a personification of the human efforts involved in bringing about this utopian age. And so all these people working together to set up Israel and Palestine and eventually to get rid of all war, have worldwide peace, Messiah is the personification of that human effort to pull that off. Those who consider themselves Orthodox Jews and Zionist in the conservative sense are still expecting one sent from God to fulfill those prophecies and to bring that about. Zionism. Let's talk about that for just a minute. It's defined in the Jewish Virtual Library as the national movement for the return of the Jewish people to their homeland and the resumption of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. Okay? Now, there are disagreements, and over the years, there have been disagreements among Jews about just what that means, and so they sort of divided up into a number of camps: political Zionism, religious Zionism, socialist Zionism, and territorial. If we look at those real quickly, the political Zionists stress the importance of a political action and deem the attainment of political rights in Palestine a prerequisite for the fulfillment of the Zionist enterprise. What they're saying is that they don't have any problem with other countries pitching in and creating a state of Israel in Palestine for them, because that needs to be done first before anything else good can happen. And so they're certainly behind that. Now, those who consider themselves religious Zionists, it's a fusion, it says, of Jewish religion and nationhood, and it aims to restore not only Jewish political freedom, but also Jewish religion in the light of the Torah and its commandments. And so their religious focus, their focus is much more religious. And if they have their way, when all the smoke clears, you know, the national law of the state of Israel is going to be the law of Moses and so forth, and they'll go by that. Socialist Zionism, we won't spend a lot of time on, but frankly, there are people that were socialists and Zionists, and they blended the two together. And frankly, there are two major political parties in the state of Israel today. I want to make sure I had it on. In the state of Israel today, and one of those two major political parties is the Labor Party, and it grew out of the socialist Zionist. Territorial Zionism is frankly saying, you know what, Jews need a homeland. It frankly doesn't matter where that is. Palestine would be nice, but if that didn't work out, it could be Ukraine, it could be Ecuador, Australia, it could be any number of places. And those experiments were tried between World War I and World War II. None of them were really successful. Okay. Now, there are some Jews who consider themselves non-Zionists, but it's a tricky term. They don't mean they're anti-Zionist. They're still looking for God to set up, to restore the nation of Israel, bring Messiah to reign over them, bring world peace and so forth, but they believe it's going to be a miraculous thing. And these folks are not even supportive of the current state of Israel because it was a political move. And they believe it's going to be a miraculous thing on the part of God. And so they call themselves non-Zionists, but they just believe in Zionism in a different a little bit different form. Why no animal sacrifices? Well, I'm not going to try to pronounce this fellow's. Well, I'll try to pronounce it, but you'll have to forgive me. But Maimonides or Maimonides helped define...
Maimonides,
thank you.
Maimonides.
Good, thanks. I've been educated. I like it. Maimonides helped to define the modern view today that most Jews have and the arguments they make for not offering animal sacrifices. Here were his points. Animal sacrifice was the general practice of all the nations. When the Jews were coming out of Egypt, all the nations were making animal sacrifices to their gods. Many of those were associated with idolatrous practices. Number three, God never commanded animal sacrifices. He simply allowed it and redefined animal sacrifices to remove the idolatrous elements from it. Number four, if a Jew in that day was forced to give up animal sacrifices, it would have been contrary to the nature of man who generally cleaves to that to which he is used. In other words, if you're used to doing something, you just want to continue doing that. It becomes part of your nature. And so if God had forced them to stop doing that, it would have been unnatural for them. And so he allowed them to continue making animal sacrifices. Now, that's okay. That's okay. If you're determined to follow the parts of the old law that you want to follow, and that's just not up to date, and we can't justify to our neighbors doing those guys. That argument is so weak that that's the best they can do, because we all scratch our heads and wonder why they don't have an altar and they're offering animal sacrifices. Because there's no logical reason not to. And folks, that's not a logical reason. To take the position that God never commanded animal sacrifices is beyond ludicrous. Okay, just read the book of Leviticus and tell me whether God commanded. And it was even, if you didn't do it exactly like he said, he was going to be displeased. That doesn't sound like a God that's simply letting you sort of roll with the flow and do what you want. It is a weak argument. And yet the same men that will make this argument to get rid of animal sacrifices are the same one that will make up some story about the Torah being around 2,000 years before the creation. It's just man's theories, and people are living by it as if, and their souls depend on what they're living by. Well, quick conclusion. Judaism is loosely based on the religion of the children of Israel. Okay, I mean, that's the only way we can say it. It has to be loosely based on it. They're still relying on traditions of men, and that's a problem. That gets them into trouble. Their rejection of Jesus of Nazareth is based on the same misconceptions as our premillennial friends around us, and that is they're looking for an earthly kingdom with an earthly king sitting on an earthly throne in the city of Jerusalem, and our premillennial friends are just as wrong as those involved in Judaism. They just happen to accept Jesus, but they're totally confused as to what his role and mission was when he came. And then number three, Zionism among both Jews and premillennial Christians have created a lot of problems, frankly. Okay, and 1948 with leaders of the Allies who went in and displaced a lot of Palestinian people and gave their homes and their land to people that migrated there from around the world who happened to be Jewish. I'm not saying it created the problem, but it's contributed to a lot of problems. Okay, and it's simply because people had misconceptions about what the New Testament teaches. Okay? There's nothing in the scriptures to teach that anybody has any right to the land of Palestine from a religious standpoint, and to move people out of their homes and give it to someone else was a mistake based on misconceptions about the scriptures. We need to keep in mind that these are good-hearted, sincere folks. You know, and it's not a matter of making fun of someone. It's not a matter of being hateful towards someone. The Apostle Paul said in Romans 10 and verse 2, you know, that I'll testify that they have a zeal for God, that they really do, but it's not according to knowledge. If you drop back in verse 1, he said, "Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved." Saul or Paul at one time said, "If I could be accursed myself on their behalf, I would." I can't do that. Every man is going to stand before God himself. But I love my people. I want them to be saved. And God feels the same way. And we should feel the same way. You know, I mean, it's a matter of love. It's not a matter of criticism. And finally, all of us are in the same boat spiritually. We really are. A lot of Gentiles around, few Jews around. But you know, it doesn't matter. Okay? Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." Doesn't matter if you're from, you know, Italy or Ireland, Germany, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter if your background is Jewish. If you don't come to the Father through the Son, then that's the only way to come. And these folks are going to have to accept Jesus of Nazareth as the Messiah, or they can't have access to the Father. That's just simply what the New Testament teaches, what Jesus taught. He's either who he said he was or he's not. If you're here this evening, you're not a Christian. You need to be. Okay, Jesus of Nazareth was in fact the one who had been prophesied for centuries, and he gave his life for you. He was the propitiation for the sins that you've committed. And there's a responsibility that comes with that, and that is that I'm responsible and you're responsible for making him the Lord of your life and the Lord of my life. If you're here and you're already a Christian, we need to do our best to help our friends and neighbors, and not with some sort of haughty attitude or I'm smarter than you are. We need to sit down and study with them and help them to understand the miracles that Jesus performed when he was here. All the evidence is pointing toward Jesus, in fact, fulfilling all those prophecies from the Old Testament, and do our best to create faith in those around us so they can be saved. If there's anyone here who's subject to the invitation this evening, come forward and make that known while we stand and sing.